Having said that, people are working towards putting together, pretty much what you asked, a kind of an index or a collection. Now, what we're going to have, and I've got a man working, Richard Gill. Mr. Marcella, I think, has talked to him over the telephone. One of my brightest students at the State of the University there, in graduate school. And we should have finished by the 10th of April and put copies into the hands of all the participants among the affiliates that come, an index with a little description of about 450 Roman documents on the religious life since the Council. That's a lot of documents. It's about one third of the total. I spent over a year reading through and selecting the documents. And now I'm getting worried because we've still got so many. So people are doing this. Now here is one such collection published by my Jesuit confrere, Father Joseph Gellin. You may have heard the name. A very fine canonist. They go to a quarter of, don't they? What if I do this for the rest of the period? Quote, just a few, just samples of some of the modifications in canon law since Second Vatican. The term virginity has a specific meaning and should never be substituted in the constitutions for the word chastity. Right? That was passed on July the 10th, 1972, by the Congregation for Liberty. Makes sense, right? Some people in their apostolic zeal substitute virginity for chastity. That does raise a few problems. In any case, Rome told them to cease and desist. Monasteries and institutes of men, not exclusively lay and character, can admit both clergy and laity on the same basis. Listen, on the same basis, and with equal rights and duties, excepting those that pertain to sacred orders. You get it? That doesn't mean that they must. Notice, they can. The Holy See has permitted monasteries, this is a major development, has permitted monasteries to accept men into their institutes, whether they would become priests or not, and to have the self-same rights as religious. So that isn't it true? Is it in Melitown? Don't they have a brother who is superior over priests? What? It is in the light of this major revision in the Church's law. The Institutes of Brothers may admit some members to holy orders for priestly ministrations for their own houses. Notice how carefully this is worded. They may admit some members to holy orders for priestly ministrations for their own houses. One of the problems, centuries old, about 1,000 years old, one of the problems with the once strong men's communities, to get admitted men to holy orders, at first to take care of the immediate needs of the community, but the priests got rested, and the rest is a matter of record. You follow the legend. They then became often more interested in things outside the community, even in monastic institutions, than their own institute. Suppression of an exempt house. The consent of the Holy See is suspended for the suppression of a house of an exempt religious institute. In other words, the Holy See used to have to give explicit permission even to suspend the suppression of a pontifical, of a house of pontifical institutes. The Church has modified that, and the suspension may be done even by the local ordinary. What? One of the major changes regarding the confessors of religious. All religious men and women, clerical and lay, exempt and non-exempt. Here are the five main provisions of the law regarding confession. Should strive to receive the sacrament of penance frequently, that is, at least twice a month. Superiors are to encourage this frequency and make it possible for the members to go to confession at least every 2 weeks. Having it oftener, if they wish to do so. Second, make their confession validly and licitly. This is the major change. Validly and licitly to any priest approved for hearing confessions in the locality. Until this change, as you know, a priest had to be authorized to approve, say, sisters' confessions, even for valid absolution. Third, an ordinary confessor is to be named for monasteries of contemplative nuns. In other institutes of men or women for houses of formation and large houses may be named in special circumstances at the request of the community. An extraordinary confessor is to be named at least for monasteries of contemplative nuns and houses of formation. However, there is no obligation to go to confession to any of these confessors. Very specific. The local ordinary is to choose the ordinary and extraordinary confessors of women religious with care and may determine their number, age, term of office, and reappointment. I should add, however, that has since been modified. In other words, the community may, always of course, appealing to the confessor, may choose its own confessor. But it has to be approved, of course, by the bishop. There is no single area, listen to this, there is no single area on which the Holy See has more legislation than the obligation to wear the religious habit. Isn't that something? And you know why? It seems for many people laws don't make any difference. Then, there's a great deal on novices. Their age, their formation, their dress, separation of novices. You know, novices are supposed to be separated. You don't want to say segregated. There must be some separation between the novices and the professed religious, with whom, however, and with other communities, the novices may have contact according to the judgment of the director of novices. Then their formation. That is the formation of those in the novitiate. For the first time in centuries, the Church has drafted the right of religious profession, which is a model for communities to follow. Individual and personal decisions may be made before or after the approved formula. Some communities allow the religious to add when you make your vows, either something before or after, but don't tamper with the formula. Now the big one that I mentioned this morning. This is regarding poverty. Let me read the whole thing. It'll take a few minutes, but it's pertinent. The renunciation of personal patrimony by a professor of simple vows in religious congregations. Now, I think, didn't we, certainly those who were here last year, we went to a great deal of trouble to explain the difference between religious orders and congregations. Remember? On the matter of poverty, a religious order takes what we call a solemn vow of poverty. The essence of a solemn vow of poverty is dispossession. There are three parts, as the churches over the centuries understood poverty, there are three essential parts to all religious poverty. Part one, there must be sharing, which is taken care of by community life. That whatever you have does not belong to you in the community, but belongs to everyone. Sit down to the same meal. Some, as I found out in the novitiate, need more, but I made my adjustment long ago. Some simply need more. And by the time the novitiate was over, I found myself doing the charitable thing of even, because I didn't see there was so much on the platter, and it's all the man next to me. I'm sure he thought to himself, gosh, if I get just a mathematical six at a table, I won't be getting much, and he needs more. I found myself taking less to give the man next to me a little more. But that's the first poverty, the poverty of sharing. The second is the poverty of dependence. There is no religious life without dependence on superiors and the community for the needs you have as a religion. They should be provided for generously. That's the first premise. It's like a law of Newton. People always want more than they need. And they want things they don't need. And they need a lot of things they don't want. Now, those are the two givens of all religious poverty in the Catholic Church. Sharing, which is community living, and dependence. Sister?
I'd like to know if you know what you don't need. You know, if you need
to determine what you don't need. Well, I wouldn't use the verb determine what you need. The community should, well, after reflection and study, perhaps decide what you need. That's all. But it should not be an arbitrary determination. But now the third part of poverty, and this is where this comes in, dispossession. Dispossession means beyond sharing, beyond depending, you give up. The giving up of your possessions is in the gospel. To be exact, it's in that famous dialogue between Christ and the rich young man. Remember? After having said that he kept the commandments from his youth, what more is wanting to me? And Christ told him, and that's the rock bottom of religious life. If you will be perfect, go sell what you have, give the proceeds to the poor, and then, that important adverb, and then come, follow me. For the first 1600 years in the Catholic Church, there was no religious life without dispossession. For the last 350 years, since Vincent de Paul, who was the first to introduce religious congregations approved by Rome, now they are the majority of religious in the church. on her simple vows. But a simple vow of poverty does not require the person to give up what you own. He must give up the administration. He must depend on the community. He must share. But you continue to own. I cannot tell you how thrilled I was. How often I thank God for the Second Vatican Council's decision to open the door to returning religious life to its origins. There are two statements, and even if this takes a few more minutes, beyond a quarter of, this is much too important. The first statement on the subject came in Perfecti Caritatis in Vatican II. It reads as follows. Religious congregations, hear it? Congregations, not orders, under simple vow, may permit in their constitutions that the members renounce their patrimonial property, what they own, whether already acquired or to be acquired in the future. Are we clear? Vatican II therefore opened the door for the first time in 350 years that if congregations wish, they may revise their constitutions to bring them back to the way all constitutions were before the 17th century. So you not only don't use what you have without permission, but you don't own it, you give it up. But Paul VI went beyond. Ecclesiae Sanctae, we've gone over that, haven't we? Ecclesiae Sanctae, it is that motu proprio of Paul VI which implements four major decrees of the Council, including Perfecti Caritatis. Here's what the Pope says. Institutes of simple vows may themselves decide in their general chapter whether there should be introduced into the Constitution a renunciation of property already acquired or to be acquired. All right? That's a repetition of Vatican II. I hear the Pope adds. And if it is decided to do so, if the chapter decides to thus change, it may further decide whether it should be obligatory or voluntary. I all but wept when I read that. Thank God. Obligatory dispossession. It's still an option. Notice? Well, thank God it's an option. Chapters may vote in dispossession as an obligation. And I was pushed a little bit this morning, I forget by whom, was it you, brother? And what difference does it make? Oh, believe me, it makes all the difference in the world. Once you dispossess yourself of everything, present and future, something happens to you. All that I think is psychological, but it's mainly supernatural. You say to yourself, well, now I am following Christ's invitation, literally. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen.